The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. One of the great guiding questions for any life, but certainly for a Buddhist life, is the question, is it helpful? To carry that question with you and ask that, you know, when you have to make a decision, when you have to make a choice, do something, to ask, is it helpful or is it useful? And this kind of self-reflection with that kind of question is kind of a little bit behind the whole teachings of Buddhism. But Buddhism offers it in a different word than helpful or useful. It uses the word skillful. Is it skillful what we're about to do? And but kind of in more simply, helpful or useful makes it more kind of immediate for us. There's a famous little poem that comes from the earliest periods of Buddhism that encapsulates the Buddha's teaching in three lines. And those are, refrain from doing evil, engage in what is skillful, purify the mind. This is the teachings of the Buddha. So avoid doing evil means don't harm anyone intentionally. I think the intentional causing of harm is, in the Buddhist tradition, is, I don't know if evil is the best translation of the Buddhist word, but it's a strong word for the intentional causing of harm. So avoid causing harm. And then engage in what's skillful. Purify the mind. This is the teachings of the Buddha. So the idea of being skillful. The other place where the concept of skillfulness is very important in Buddhism is in the area of ethics. Rather than judging something as being good or bad, the discernment, the evaluation is what we're doing skillful? And the most common list of ethical guidelines in Buddhism, in the early tradition, are not the precepts, but rather are something called the 10 skillful actions. So 10 actions, if you do these things, they're helpful, they're useful. They overlap with the precepts because the idea is that it's skillful and helpful and useful not to kill anyone. It's skillful not to steal. It's skillful not to engage in sexual misconduct. It's skillful not to lie. It's skillful not to have harsh speech. It's skillful not to have frivolous speech or idle speech, sometimes it's said. It's skillful not to slander anybody. It's skillful not to have covetousness, to have greed, to want things that other people have. It's skillful not to have hate, and it's skillful to have what's called right view, to understand basically what is skillful and what is not skillful. So even though they overlap with the precepts, the rationale or the background for these 10 skillful actions is this idea, is it helpful? And then the idea of helpful, skillful, begs the question, for what purpose? And so the purpose in that three-line poem is to purify the mind. And this is one way of talking, the ancient world, where purity was a very important concept, of saying, having a mind which is not agitated. An unagitated mind is said to be a mind which is on the brink of awakening or becomes awake, becomes free. And you know, in some ways, it's in purity from agitation. And so the goal or the direction, how do you have a peaceful mind or a peaceful heart, an unagitated heart? It's so radically unagitated, so settled and peaceful that it leads or is itself an experience of radical freedom or liberation or awakening. So that's kind of the guide. It's that what is it skillful for attaining this peaceful, happy heart? Another way of saying it that the tradition says is that you want to do what's skillful that brings you the highest benefit, the greatest benefit. And so that takes some evaluation. You know, what is beneficial? What's onward leading? What's supportive of really benefiting you? In some ways, this kind of evaluation, this kind of discussion might not seem particularly spiritual, especially here in the West, where spirituality sometimes is more in reference to some spiritual reality or to spiritual beings or something beyond oneself or outside oneself. And this kind of Buddhist approach is so internal with yourself, understanding yourself, working with yourself, and all this. And but it's remarkable what happens when we develop a skillful heart, a skillful mind, and we become unagitated and experience a sense of wholeness and peace where the whole world somehow is held in this field of consciousness, field of the heart. It's a wonderful thing. So skillfulness. I'm fond of this word skill because the Indo-European origins of the word means to separate things apart. And in fact, in Norwegian, the word skill, because of this, you know, how the K and H sounds in Indo-European languages are interchangeable, is to skille, which means to separate. And so the kind of one of the original background meanings for skill is to make finer and finer distinctions. In fact, people who develop great skills from repetition, a swimmer who swims over and over and over again, they get so familiar with the simple, repetitive strokes that they make in the water that they start making finer and finer distinctions in order to become really skillful. And every little, teeniest little muscle becomes more and more efficient, just kind of putting the hand through the water. Playing musical instruments, all kinds of things, making finer and finer distinctions to kind of perfect it. I've had people tell me that they watched a Zen master, Zen teacher, bow to the altar, and they were blown away at somehow the full presence and engagement and just the act of bowing. Now this person, if it's a Zen master, probably has bowed, I don't know, 100,000 times in their life. I once counted how many times I bowed when I was in the Zen monastery before 10 o'clock in the morning. And I think I got something like 50 times. You know, just, you know, that's just until 10. And so a Zen master who has bowed and bowed and bowed, it becomes a vehicle for making, you know, developing a skill, finer, finer distinctions, so that he's completely or she's completely engaged in the act of bowing, no distractions, everything, all, you know, everything's there just for that one activity, just to bow. So this ability to give oneself over fully, to do something in a skillful way, is often very inspiring for us. Some of us love to watch athletes or dancers or different people who are masters of their skill. It just seems so beautiful, so elegant to watch. So in Buddhism, the idea is to develop a skill. The difference between using the word skill and usefulness, skill and helpfulness, what's helpful and what's skillful, is that helpful kind of implies an activity, whereas the word skill has dual implications, I believe, between the skill that we do and then a quality of training that we have. We develop a skill. And so we might not be developing a skill if we do something helpful. It might be helpful just for today and never again, what we do. But to have a skill is to have a capacity, to have an ability that we cultivate and develop. And skills and abilities are portable. We can take them with us all over the place. In contrast to experiences, it's been observed that many people in the West who are interested in Buddhism tend to have an overdone attraction to having experiences, spiritual experiences, states of calm, peace, bliss, love, whatever, a variety of things, as if having the experience is a thing that's really going to count, really, you know, you've arrived, or it's really pleasant, it's really nice, it's confirming, it's meaningful or something. And certainly experiences are important in Buddhist training, but historically what's important is more than experiences is the skillfulness, the skills we develop. Skills in mindfulness, skills in concentration, skills in kindness, skills in honesty, skills in patience, skills in wisdom. And here, in this topic of skill, some people, the word that's translated as wisdom, some translators translate it as discernment. And that goes along with the idea of skill. To be discerning, again, means to make distinctions, to see clearly. And the primary distinction that we want to make is distinction, is it helpful or not helpful? Does it lead us to greater happiness and well-being, or does it bring us down? Does it somehow cause us more stress, more anxiety, more agitation? And to become discerning and skilled at recognizing this distinction is something that becomes more and more important the deeper a person goes, for example, in deep meditation. In deep meditation, you have to become your own guide, your own teacher, to find the way, the path of meditation. And at some point, what becomes the guide is you really can feel and sense that those movements of the mind which are deleterious that or stressful or kind of lead you to more agitation or contraction or you know, closes things down, or that movement of mind that opens you up, that relaxes you, that creates more peace for the mind. And that simple distinction between what is kind of what discernment or wisdom is at the heart. So rather than reading a lot of books to get Buddhist wisdom, the idea is for you to develop the skill, the capacity, to really investigate and see clearly what's actually going on here. What's the impact what I'm doing have on me? Is it helpful or not helpful? And to kind of ride that. And if you do that carefully through the day, chances are that by the end of the day, you'll feel more at ease with your life maybe than you did at the beginning. When I first started doing this many years ago, I was so surprised that rather than being tired by the end of the day, I was energized in a very nice way because I started to watch my choices, what I said, what I did, how I was. So the idea of a skill, in one of the ways that it comes out in Buddhism is the concept of skillful means. Here it means skillful activities, those useful things we can do. And it's summarized in a very succinct way, which I'll give you the colloquial expression first, because I think that'll be more meaningful than the technical wording of it. And that is... avoid danger. If you're in danger, get out of it. Stay safe. Bring yourself into some safety, and then stay safe. So this is a good, really good. I first heard this idea as someone who was a kayaker in Alaska. Actually, it was a little bit different. They said, stay out of danger when you're kayaking in Alaskan waters. If you're in danger, get out of danger. Develop skills to stay safe, and then maintain those skills. Pretty basic, right? So in Buddhism, it said in this more convoluted way, it said... avoid unskillfulness, things that are unskillful states of mind. If you have unskillful states of mind or doing something unskillful, stop it. Cultivate skillful states, skillful activities, and then maintain them. Keep them going. So it requires making these distinctions to recognize when what you're doing is not skillful. So notice you're caught. So if you're caught in agitation, caught in anger, caught in anxiety, caught in greed, kind of stressing, and you know, can be as simple as how you drive your car. To make distinctions, to drive skillfully in a Buddhist sense, is to make maybe subtle distinctions, maybe gross for you, between how you engage in driving your car. Is there any tension? Are you pushing? Are you leaning forward? Are you in a hurry and kind of zipping in and out? Are you angry at the other drivers because they're interfering with the course of human development? Don't they realize that you have important things to do in this world? And if you stop and feel, feel and sense that this is unskillful or unuseful states of mind to have, it doesn't lead to your own betterment, it doesn't lead to less agitation, to peace, to well-being, to being settled, it actually leads to more stress and builds stress over time. And so to feel that and say, well, maybe I don't have to do this. How can I stop doing it? Maybe it's not easy necessarily because there's a lot of compulsion there, or maybe it is. Maybe with driving, maybe if it's subtle kind of pushing and stress around it, maybe you can just relax. One of the fun places that I've experienced this is just at the waiting for the light to turn green. The red light has nothing personally against me. And am I going to let my well-being, my stress, my anxiety, be held hostage or directed by that traffic light? You know, waiting, turn green, what's going on here? And, it's not going to help me whatsoever to be anxious, to be eager, to be impatient while the light is waiting to turn green. Right? Why stay greedy or why stay anxious or why stay in those moments when you can't do anything about it anyway? So I've seen myself that way, and I kind of, when I finally notice it, I smile and say, okay, this is my chance to breathe and relax. And then it turns green eventually. And then I can get anxious again. This involves making distinctions and learning to recognize stress, learning to recognize constriction is a skill that you get better and better at. It becomes a habit, it becomes something to be more sensitive to. And the more sensitive we are to it, the more we're informed by that so we can make a difference. So I choose the example of driving to give you an example of something very, very simple and basic, that this is inherent in our life. In so many different activities, we can develop greater skill in mindful awareness of what we're doing, the quality of our mind, and we can start using the quality of our mind to make choices to move towards a higher quality, better quality of mind. So the word skill, the word in Pali is kusala, is both an activity that you can do, an ability, but it very much refers to the quality of the mind, to have skillful states of mind, useful, helpful states of mind. So to have mindfulness, to have ability to investigate, to have engagement with what you're doing, to have joy, to have some certain degree of calm, to be concentrated and focused on what you do, to have certain degree of equanimity and balance in what you do. These are all skillful states of mind that the tradition champions as really important to develop. To have contentment, to have a few wishes, not have too many wishes, not be too greedy for things, to be honest. These are all skillful states that can be developed. And so Buddhism keeps pointing back to your own heart, your own mind, the quality of it, the character of it, and that the idea of skillfulness, finding the path, developing yourself, has a lot to do with the ability to keep track of what's going on for you. So it takes mindfulness. This is one of the reasons why we cultivate mindfulness. Not mindfulness for its own sake, but mindfulness so it becomes a window for greater self-understanding. This is what's going on for us. Now, some people, maybe some of you, when they hear this kind of teaching, just hearing it, they get exhausted. It seems like there's a lot of doing. You have to pay attention now, and I have to make choices, and I have to kind of, not do certain things, but I have to do other things. And my God, you know, it's Buddhism is busy. But in order to do this well, the skillfulness, this discernment to look carefully, is to also be discerning about how we practice, how we engage ourselves with the activities we do. And so if it's stressful or tiring or a burden to practice mindfulness, then probably your mindfulness is somehow a little bit off. It's not your mindfulness practice is not being skillful. So the whole idea of skillfulness means you look at how you're engaged as well. You look at how you're doing your thing, whatever you're doing, how you're doing your practice. And you see, can you find a skillful way of practicing? So a skillful way of practicing is a way of practicing where you don't get tired or exhausted, where you don't feel like it's a burden, one more thing on top of your life that you have to do, and it's kind of stressful to add it. You look and see, how can I be mindful? How can I pay attention so that it's something you want to do? So it's a delight, it's a joy to do it. And for different people, there's different answers to that question. I've known people who bring a sense of playfulness into their mindfulness. They just, it's kind of just play for them. I've known people who like to do puzzles. They love puzzles, crossword puzzles and stuff. And so they found it actually helpful to do mindfulness practice as a puzzle. Like they're just curious, how does this work? And let's try this out and kind of try to figure out. And that engages them. I know other people who that wouldn't work at all. just like too much doing. And I know people who really like to have techniques. They really like to have a set of directions. You do X, Y, and Z. And then they can kind of put themselves in wholeheartedly to it. And so their instructions in meditation, for example, that can be that way. And other people just bury themselves in a grave if they start following, a set instructions. You do A, B, and C. It's better to have a much broad field, wide, relaxed approach, and let the practice kind of grow on its own to do less. And maybe for them, the most useful thing is to, because there's so much maybe of internalized doing or being self-conscious or self-critical, it's best not to do anything at all when you meditate and just kind of like do less and less and less and let mindfulness get stronger, because the less you do actively, you can't help but to become more and more aware, more and more in the present moment. It's the doing that takes you out of the present moment, the doing of the mind, the thinking about the past and the future. And so just do less and less and less. And find that's what kind of heightens and shows them what they're actually doing. Some people find that what's helpful is when they do their practice, do this mindfulness, making skillful choices, it's best contextualized or couched in a lot of love, and a lot of goodwill and friendliness, to approach it as something that is a loving thing to do, a caring thing to do, a compassionate thing. It's not like a duty. It's not like, that there's a high, like some order from high up that says, you shall be mindful or else. But it's an act of caring. It's an act of love and self-respect and caring for oneself. And some people, that kind of is a skillful thing to do. So all this points to the idea that you're supposed to become your own teacher. You're supposed to be able to learn to read, monitor yourself carefully, and not read so many Buddhist books. They're good to read, but you don't want to race through them. The idea is that they're mirrors for yourself, these books, these teachings, so that you can kind of turn back and start reading the book of your own heart, your own mind, seeing how does this work for me? What goes on in there? What is skillful? What is not skillful? What is helpful? What is not helpful? Is it helpful? That's the question. Is it useful, what I'm about to do? I have a friend who used to go up to see Ajahn Amaro, a wonderful Buddhist monk who used to live in California. And And she had all kinds of eclectic practices she did that were not Buddhist. But he was one of her teachers. So she'd go up to him and bring him her eclectic practices she did. Eclectic for Buddhists, you know. So, for example, she was very much involved in Christianity. So she'd come and talk about her Christian practices to this Buddhist monk who was a teacher. She would ask him, "Is this okay?" And she told me that inevitably his response always was, "Is it useful? Is it useful for you to do that?" So she kind of put it back to her. So then she had to kind of look at herself and reflect, you know, well, is it useful? Is it helping? But if you ask yourself, is it useful or helpful, you have to have criteria, a basis for deciding, useful for what purpose, helpful for what purpose. And if you ask that question for yourself, that requires, or that involves, I think, some deep inner reflection. What is most important for you? What is the most important values? What's the important direction for your life, purpose over your life? What is it that's really valuable that you want to do with this precious life of yours? Is your life skillful? Is the way you live your life skillful or helpful or useful to align you, to help you, support you in the values that are most important for you, the direction you want your life to be in? And I think that kind of reflecting on what is our deepest intention, our deepest values, our deepest sense of purpose, is really skillful. Because we have a society that often gives us all kinds of messages about what society thinks is important that might be pretty superficial. You know, so, you know, might not be something that has lasting value. You know, for example, consumerism. You know, when you come to your deathbed, are you going to look back over your life and be really glad, really happy, contented, delighted by all the shopping you're able to do? Wow, that was great. I shopped. It was great. Having things. But probably not. Probably that when you're in deathbed, that's not what you're going to look at as being what's going to nurture you. So what nourishes you? What nurtures your heart in a deep way? What is helpful? What is skillful? Is the Buddhist question. So, what would be helpful, useful, skillful to talk about now? We have some minutes if you have any questions or comments you'd like to make.
This talk was so beneficial, useful to me, and I just came from a conference on learning in the brain, and they're saying some of the same things you're saying about flexibility of thinking is the way they describe what sounds like the same thing. The more we can use our higher level thinking abilities and the more our thinking remains flexible, the younger our brains physically remain.
Nice. That sounds good, but I wasn't so wise when I was really young. I'm just sorry. I agree. It reminds me that I read a study once they did an experiment with children, and they kind of maybe I can't remember so well, but maybe they had like a lesson for the kids, and they did an experiment with the kids where they had them look at photographs of people, choose something like to differentiate those people. They kind of predispose the kids in one way to appreciate or look at people as people, whatever that is. And the other way, to look at people for their qualities that they had, the capacities they had. And then they had them pick teams, who they would choose to be on their basketball team or their sports team or something. And they found that the ones that had looked at people as a whole somehow tended to discriminate more between different people's abilities or something. But the people who, the kids who looked at particular qualities didn't discriminate so much between, like someone who, in a wheelchair, wasn't seen as someone who couldn't do basketball, but they had certain abilities. So I messed that up. I apologize. But the idea to look at qualities that people have rather than to kind of discriminate or judge them by the overall set of what you see. And the kids were judged, you know, that could be so easily manipulated with the kids that they either kind of judge people from what they first saw, or they're able to judge or evaluate people by their abilities. And this is what the Buddha emphasized a lot, which was kind of radical, apparently, in ancient India, was he said, you're not who you are. You shouldn't be judged by how you're born, which in ancient India means born into a caste, into a race, but rather by what you do and the qualities of the skillful qualities that you develop. And that's what makes you a great person, is the qualities of your heart, not, you know, your race or your caste or things like that. So I'm sorry I went on and on. So are there questions or comments?
I have a comment here.
Yeah.
You know, I can get so caught up in my mind, or my mind can tell me that I really have these very, very important things to do. And if I get them all done, then I'll be very skillful. Then I've accomplished a lot. So I think the most skillful thing for me to do at that point is to realize how agitated I am, or how, you know, and then to make that discernment about what would open my heart or be most, I guess, relaxing would be the most skillful thing.
Yes, I think it's great. It's wise what you said. What gets in the way from that wisdom operating?
Realizing it, kind of stopping the chattering and stopping the have-tos and the fear and the kind of the drive.
Does the have-tos that you have, the drive, does it sometimes come with a lot of authority?
Yeah. So.
Yeah, so what wisdom do you have about that authority that it comes with?
Well, that it's not helpful, that it's actually kind of rallying my, you know, revving me up, and that I'm not relaxing, that I'm, you know, just go, and agitating, and, you know.
Great, this is great you're talking about this, because this is an example of the kind of skillful mindfulness in noticing the effect that our activities have, what we're doing, the effect of what drives us, and feeling that it's not a good quality to be in. And there can be a lot of authority, sometimes arguments, that something is so important to do that will sacrifice our inner well-being, will sacrifice our peace or relaxation. And to question the authority that says it's important to be anxious, it's important to kind of get tight, and, you know, why do you believe that? Probably you've never actually thought about that. There's a belief system, and that's so authoritative that causes you to sacrifice your peace, because something seems so important. But, you know, the question is, why is it? What is so important that you're willing to sacrifice your peace for?
Nothing.
Is that a pun?
It's quality.
Great. Yes. Nothing is worth sacrificing it. So yes, please.
I had an interesting mindfulness experience while you were talking. So I always enjoy your talks, but when you first started talking, my mind kept going to a very stressful situation I have right now. And I realized that I kept missing like several of your sentences and I would have to catch up. And I got really agitated by this because I enjoy your talks. And I knew that I didn't want to be in this place, and it wasn't useful for me to be in this place, but I couldn't get out of it. And I struggled with that, and I was getting mad at the same time. And what I found is that I don't know exactly what happened, but 10, 15 minutes later, I realized I had been listening to you that whole time, and I realized I wasn't in that state anymore. And it was a good mindfulness thing to realize that the state left. And at the time, it seemed like it was never going to go, that I was struggling. And yet somehow, you know, it did go away.
Nice.
And so I think that was really good.
Oh, great, 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 great to see, a distinction, a discernment between two different states, one that wasn't so useful for you and one that was more useful, right? Okay. It's great. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing this. It reminded me of, I don't know if you've studied this much, but the Stoics used to ask always, is it good and is it useful? And the theory in Stoicism is that the good things in life, the good decisions, are also the ones that are useful. And okay. I wonder if you have some comments around how Buddhism and Stoicism maybe relate on that.
I'm not sure what to say about that, but yes, there's a the Stoics, Epicurus, Epicureans, and there's a variety of, down through time, philosophies, religions that are not theistically based. The Stoics, for the most part, were not. Epicurus was not. And utilitarianism, Mills was kind of in this category. And more recently, Sigmund Freud was this. And Buddhism, where because it's not theistically based, the tendency is not to look externally for some reference point of what thou shalt do and what is right and wrong, but rather all those kinds of philosophies or approaches have turned towards oneself, that one becomes one's own teacher, one has to measure for oneself what is useful, what is helpful to do. And so all these are kind of much more human-centered approaches. And they all have something. If I say this word, you might kind of be dismayed, but I think it's a profound word, a concept. It comes across maybe wrong. And that is, Freud had the idea of the pleasure principle. And all of these kind of approaches, the Stoics, Epicurus, utilitarianism, Freud, and Buddhism, all have something that we can call, more generally, like the pleasure principle, in that one of the really important teachers for us is our own ability to discern whether something is pleasant or unpleasant, where something brings an internal feeling of well-being or ill-being. So being the own judge of that, and the feel or sensing of that. And we know what Epicurus had this idea, but then there was other religious traditions in Europe that didn't like Epicurus, so they kind of distorted his teachings. And so the idea of becoming a hedonist, for example, Epicurean, became something very different than what he had in mind. So the reason why I'm sensitive around calling the pleasure principle, the kind of Freud's idea, is that it might seem reductionistic or might seem hedonistic. You know, that's what it all comes down to. But the idea is that it's our own. We have to have something inside, some criteria, to really be able to discern and feel what leads us to a higher quality, better quality, a more useful way of being. And so the idea of is it useful? Is it conducive to well-being? Is something we measure for ourselves. So that kind of...
Yeah, I think that's nice. I think maybe the word eudaimonia would maybe kind of describe, again, that more state of pleasure could be more like temporarily, like a good food, but then eudaimonia would be like the well-being that you were talking about. So
it's a higher level than...
Yeah, so is it good for that eudaimonia versus just good for pleasure? So, yeah, thank you.
Okay. So, it's time to stop. But you are so enthusiastic that maybe we can take one more if you think I can. And I'll try to answer quickly.
I was just noticing that I'm asking myself, like, is it useful or not? And thinking of an agitated state, I feel often at work. But it keeps on happening. And I know that agitated state's not useful. But I'm wondering, like, why this sort of so dichotomous set of questions, because it kind of makes me think it must be useful somehow, but I just don't know how.
Ah.
So, like,
what's your thoughts on asking the question, how is this useful, even if it doesn't seem to be useful?
I see. How about if I ask, rather than asking that question, asking, when was it useful? So, for example, anxiety was probably useful when you're getting close to the mountain lion's lair. You know, having a little extra cautious and all that. But, you know, so fear has its place. But to have chronic fear, you know, it becomes a habit. And the mountain lion's not anywhere nearby. And so there probably was a time that being anxious or being, you know, heightened concern was useful in terms of finding your place in your society, your place. But when it becomes a habit, when there's deep underlying feelings of anxiety or ambition or fear or hostility that become kind of like deeply ingrained in who we are, then it loses its usefulness. So there might be particular times when the state you're in might be useful, but to have it chronically, I think, means that we've left the realm of usefulness. Okay. Well, thank you all. And